You're listening to ESL Podcasts, English Cafe, number 117. This is the English Cafe, episode 117. I'm your host, Dr. Jeff McQuillan, coming to you from the Center for Educational Development in beautiful Los Angeles, California. Visit our website at eslpod.com and download the learning guide for this episode. You can also take a look at our ESL podcast blog and our ESL podcast store, which has some additional specialized courses in daily and business English. On this cafe, we're going to talk about traveling in the United States for business. We're going to interview someone who used to travel a lot for his work. We'll talk about some of his experiences doing that. That's part of our Ask an American series that we do every month or so. We'll also, of course, answer some of your questions. Let's get started. On this episode, we have another Ask an American segment where we talk to a native speaker who speaks at a normal speed, and we listen to them go back and explain what they said and listen to them again. The topic for today's Ask an American is traveling in the United States, especially business travel. We're going to interview Kevin, who travels or used to travel a lot for his job. You may remember Kevin from English Cafe number 95, where he talked about how he got his master's in business administration, or MBA. In this episode, he's going to talk about his experiences traveling. He's going to start by talking about his travel schedule, how long he would have to go on a trip, where he went, and what he did there. Let's listen.
I used to travel from Sunday to Friday, leave Sunday morning, come back Friday evening, just work all day wherever the location was that I was working at. Typically, back then, it was our data centers, so I would travel to these remote places where they have our data centers and work out of those offices.
Kevin speaks quickly, but let's go back and listen again to what he said. He said, I used to travel, meaning in the past, I frequently traveled, from Sunday to Friday, leaving Sunday morning, come back Friday evening. Now, of course, when we speak in normal conversation, we don't always have what we would call complete sentences. It's very common. You will also notice that there are a lot of what we call filler words in normal conversation. A filler, F-I-L-L-E-R, word is a word we use when we are thinking about what we are going to say. Kevin uses and ah, those sounds when he's thinking about what to say next. So he says he used to travel from Sunday to Friday, leave Sunday morning, and come back, return to his house on Friday evening. Just work all day, he said, wherever the location was that I was working at. Meaning he would work the entire day at the place where he was sent to work. Typically, he says, meaning usually, back then, back at the time when I used to travel, it was our data centers. A data center is where computer companies have their computers that have important information on them. Kevin would travel to these data centers. He would have to travel to these remote places, somewhere that is remote, R-E-M-O-T-E, means not close to anything else, not close to a big city, for example. Well, Kevin would travel to these remote places where they had their data centers and work out of those offices. To work out of a place is a phrasal verb, which means to work in a certain location. Some people say, I work out of my home, meaning they work in their home. That's the place they work. Someone else may say, I work out of the office in San Francisco. That's the place where I work, in San Francisco. Let's listen to Kevin again.
I used to travel from Sunday to Friday, leave Sunday morning, come back Friday evening, just work all day wherever the location was that I was working at. Typically, back then, it was our data centers, so I would travel to these remote places where they have our data centers and work out of those offices.
Next, Kevin is going to talk about the differences in traveling before 9/11, before September 11th, 2001, when the World Trade Center in New York, among other places, was attacked, and what happened after September 11th, 2001, the change in flying in the United States. Let's take a listen.
But the different experiences came before 9/11 and after 9/11. Before 9/11 it was awesome. Flying was great. I loved flying. Planes weren't very full. You could get through a security line in 30 seconds. You didn't have to undress. You didn't have to unpack your bags and show them every little thing that you had. So, you know, travel was cool.
Kevin begins by saying, but the different experiences came before 9/11 and after 9/11. Before 9/11, he says, it was awesome. The word awesome, A-W-E-S-O-M-E, means in this case it was great. It's a word that was more popular in the 80s and the 90s, but it's still used. If someone says that's awesome, they mean that's fantastic. In Great Britain, they may say that's brilliant. Kevin says flying was great. I loved flying. Planes weren't very full. The planes didn't have a lot of people on them. They weren't very full. You could get through a security line in 30 seconds. To get through something is a phrasal verb meaning you could move through. You would not spend very much time in. To get through the security line means you would only be in the security line for that amount of time. Kevin says it used to take 30 seconds to get through a security line, the place where they check you and make sure that you're not carrying anything dangerous on the plane. He says you didn't have to undress, meaning take parts of your clothes off. You didn't have to unpack your bags, meaning take things out of your luggage to show the security officers. You didn't have to show them, the security officers, every little thing that you had. Notice he says every little thing. This is just another way of emphasizing when you say little here, meaning every single thing, every thing that is in your bag, every little thing. He says, so, you know, travel was cool. We use, you know, as a way of getting people to agree with us or to make sure they understand us. To say travel was cool is similar to saying it was awesome. It was good. It was fun. I used to travel a lot myself before 9/11 2001. And I know what Kevin is talking about. It's true. Travel was much, much easier, much more enjoyable before that time. Let's listen to Kevin again.
But the different experiences came before 9/11 and after 9/11. Before 9/11 it was awesome. Flying was great. I loved flying. Planes weren't very full. You could get through a security line in 30 seconds. You didn't have to undress. You didn't have to unpack your bags and show them every little thing that you had. So, you know, travel was cool.
Now Kevin is going to talk about travel after 9/11, what he thinks about traveling, the reasons he doesn't like to travel anymore. He's going to talk about what you have to do now when you go to an American airport and go through security. He's also going to talk about his own little tricks when he travels. Let's listen.
Of course, after 9/11, it's become a major pain. It's just, I hate traveling now. As much as possible, I try to avoid it because, you know, I don't wear slippers to the airport, so I have to take off my shoes. If they see that I have a belt on, I have to take off my belt. But I usually untuck my shirt so they don't see it. Because it doesn't, I know it doesn't beep, it never beeps, but if they see it, they make me take it off. Yeah, so it's just a real, it's a real trial now to travel, and that's why I try to keep it to a minimum.
Kevin says, of course, after 9/11, it's become a major pain. Air travel has become a major pain. When we say something is a pain, in this instance, we mean it's very inconvenient. It's not pleasant. The use of the word major here is like the use of the word very. It is very much a pain. It is a big pain. So major here means big, large, something that will cause a lot of problems in this case, a major pain. He says, it's just, I hate traveling now. We use that expression, it's just or it's just that, to mean, here is what I'm trying to say. This is the most important thing. It's just that I hate traveling now. As much as possible, I try to avoid it. I try not to travel. He then says, you know, I don't wear slippers to the airport. Slippers, S-L-I-P-P-E-R-S, are things that you put on your feet. They are shoes that you don't have to tie. They are shoes that you can just put on and take off very easily. Normally, we talk about slippers. We talk about the kinds of shoes that you wear only in your house. Kevin says that he wears regular shoes, so he has to take them off. At most American airports, when you go through security, you have to remove your shoes, and the shoes have to go through the X-ray machine. Kevin says, if they, the security officers, see that I have a belt on, I have to take off my belt. Again, this is true. If you have a metal belt, especially a metal belt buckle, the buckle is the part of the belt in front that connects the belt together, you have to often take it off and put it through the X-ray machine. Kevin has his own little trick, however. He says, I usually untuck my shirt so that they don't see it. To tuck, T-U-C-K, your shirt in means that for a man in particular, you take the shirt and you put the bottom of the shirt inside your pants. So to untuck your shirt is to pull your shirt out. In this case, Kevin pulls the shirt out so that they can't see his belt buckle. He says, because it doesn't, you know, it doesn't beep. B-E-E-P means it doesn't make a certain sound. To beep would be, for example, beep, 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 beep. That might be the sound that the security machine makes in the airport if it detects metal, some sort of metal on your body, or that you are carrying something in your pocket. What Kevin is saying here is that he covers up his belt because he knows that it's not going to make the metal detector, the machine that you find in the airport that you have to walk through before you can get on your plane. It doesn't detect, it doesn't pick up his belt. You hear me laughing in the background, of course, because this is sort of a strange thing to do, try to hide something from the security officers. He says, it never beeps, but if they see it, they make me take it off. He finishes by saying, yeah, so it's a real trial now to travel. When you say something is a trial, in this instance, in this case, we mean that it's a difficult thing to do. It's a difficult experience. That's why, Kevin says, I try to keep it to a minimum. To keep something to a minimum means to do it as little as possible, the least amount possible. You could also say, for example, let's keep the noise to a minimum, meaning let's be quiet, let's not be shouting. You may say that to a group of students or a group of children or a group of politicians. It's all the same. Let's listen to Kevin once more.
Of course, after 9/11, it's become a major pain. It's just I hate traveling now. As much as possible, I try to avoid it because, you know, I don't wear slippers to the airport, so I have to take off my shoes. If they see that I have a belt on, I have to take off my belt. I usually untuck my shirt so they don't see it. Because it doesn't, I know it doesn't beep, it never beeps, but if they see it, they make me take it off. Yeah, so it's just a real trial now to travel, and that's why I try to keep it to a minimum.
Thanks to Kevin for sitting down and having that short interview with us about how it is to travel for business now in the United States. Now let's answer a few of your questions. Our first question comes from Jehudi, J-E-H-U-D-I, in Colombia. Jehudi wants to know the meaning of the expression bang for your buck. Bang, B-A-N-G, for your buck, is used when we're talking about how much you get from whatever you're buying, whatever you're purchasing. Are you getting a good value? Are you getting a lot for your money? If you say, this car gives you a lot of bang for your buck, we mean that you are getting a lot from this car compared to what you are paying for it. Your money, in other words, is well spent. You're getting a good deal, a good value from your purchase. A buck is, you may know, slang for a dollar. The word bang usually describes a loud sound. So here we're talking about getting a lot of something from your money. For example, I only have $30 to spend on some new shoes, so I'm looking for a good bang for my buck, something that's good quality and looks nice but isn't too expensive. Not easy to do. Our next question comes from Crane, C-R-A-N-E, in China. Crane has a question about the difference between original and initial. Many times these two words mean the same thing. They mean something at the beginning, the first thing of something. For example, my initial impression of him was that he was lazy. My initial impression, my first impression, what I first thought of him. You could also say my original impression of him was that he was lazy. You could say my original plan was to move our office to Miami, but I changed my mind. You could also say my initial plan was to move our offices to Miami, but I've changed my mind. Both of them mean the first thing, the first idea. There are some differences, however. Original is used when we are talking about something that was used, produced, or present at the beginning of something. For example, if you are talking about a car, you can talk about the original tires. Those are the tires that came with the car when you bought it, the first tires. But we wouldn't say the initial tires. Initial is used more to talk about something that existed or occurred at the beginning of something. For example, my initial idea was to record today's podcast while sitting in a cafe. But then I changed my mind and I had another idea, a better idea. We also use the word original to mean authentic or real. For example, do you think this painting is an original Picasso? Is it a real Picasso painting? Original also is used to describe ideas that are not like anyone else's, that are not dependent on other people's ideas, that are unique. Her ideas are the most original I've ever seen. She's the most unique. It's not like anyone else. You can't use initial for either of those meanings. Initial also has an additional meaning, which is the first letter of your first and last name. For example, my initials are J.M., Jeff McQuillan. You can also use initial as a verb when you sign a contract, an agreement for a rental car. They will ask you to initial the contract in several places. That means you will write your initials, the first letter of your first name and the first letter of your last name, instead of your entire signature. If they want your full name, they'll say, sign this. But if they say initial this, they just want the first letters of your first and last name. Finally, Jason, J-A-S-O-N, from China, wants to know what the longest English word is, how to pronounce it, and how to spell it. Well, that's an interesting question. Most native speakers are taught in school, at least I was, that the longest word in English is anti-disestablishmentarianism. Anti-disestablishmentarianism was a movement, a political movement in the 19th century that opposed or was against separating the church from the government, especially in the case of Ireland, which was in the 19th century part of Great Britain. There was a movement to disestablish the Church of Ireland, the official Anglican Church in Ireland. To disestablish would mean to say it's no longer the official church. In many European countries, especially, there is or used to be an official church that the government would support. So in Ireland, because it was a largely Catholic country, there was a movement to get rid of the official sanction, the official support of the Anglican Church, we're anti-disestablishmentarians, and their belief was called anti-disestablishmentarianism, putting the letters ISM at the end of a word. Usually means it has to do with your system of beliefs about something. Well, anti-disestablishmentarianism is 28 letters long. You can look at the website or our learning guide to see it written. You could, of course, even make this word longer by adding suffixes, things at the end. For example, anti-disestablishmentarianistically would be the adverb that you could form. English, like many languages, is one where you can add things before the word and after the word, prefixes before, suffixes after, to change the meaning of the word and, of course, to make it longer if that is what you desire. There are actually longer words in most major English dictionaries, however. The Oxford English Dictionary has a word that is 30 letters long. It is pseudo-pseudo-hypoparathyroidism. This is a medical term. I have no idea what it means. There is an even longer word, a 45-letter word, that refers to a lung disease that you get by inhaling or breathing in a certain substance, a certain particle, near a volcano. The particle, the little thing that you're breathing into your lungs, is called silica. But the entire word is almost unpronounceable, at least by me. I will try. The word actually consists of a number of other words put together. The words inside of this word are pneumono, which has to do with your lung, ultra, which means very, ultra microscopic means very small, something you could only see with a microscope. It also contains the word silica, meaning the silica particle. It contains part of the word volcano as well. So, here is how it is, I think, pronounced. Pneumono ultramicroscopic silicovolcanoconiosis. Easy, right? If you have a question for the English Cafe, something a little easier, you can email us. Our email address is esl.pod@esl.pod.com. From Los Angeles, California, I'm Jeff McQuillan. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on The English Cafe. ESL Podcast English Cafe is written and produced by Dr. Jeff McQuillan and Dr. Lucy Say.
This podcast is copyright 2007 by the Center for Educational Development.